Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power, with your host, Rick Moran, like Diogenes without a lantern. And welcome, welcome, welcome all to the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran, and joining us in about 15 minutes will be Mary Catherine Hamm. Yes, that Mary Catherine Hamm, who you've probably seen on Fox News. She's been on MSNBC. She's in everywhere, and she's written a book. Yes, she has. And we'll be talking about that, as well as Scott Walker, the targeted Scott Walker. And we'll also get into patriotism a little bit, see if we can get some blood going on the right up here. In the meantime, I'd like to bring on my co-host for this evening, the wise, the wonderful, the powerful, the all-knowing, Jazz Shaw. Jazz, wave to the people.
Good evening. It's always a pleasure to be back here, and just remind everyone that this is Jazz Shaw of Hot Air, and I am pretty much the Larry King of podcasters.
Larry King works for a Russian propaganda organ now. Are you trying to equate yourself with him? He works for RT, you know.
No, I was more referring to the fact that people hear me on a podcast and they go, wait, he's still alive?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Actually, yeah, you should listen to Jazz's podcast. What's it called again? Politinerd or something?
Politinerds, yes.
Yes. And, of course, you've never had me on, but I'm not a nerd, so there. I don't deserve to be on.
Oh, we're getting to you. We just had a few good bites in the beginning, so. And it's only a weekly thing, you know, it's like yours, it's. We've had some
and
good
I'm
guests.
Not on TV. I know you have.
Well, that's
yes, true.
We had two congressmen. We had Ambassador John Bolton, Ben Carson's manager. We just had Jake Tepper. It's been fun.
Yeah, that's a little out of my league. So, I mean, I'm excited when I get Mary Catherine Hamm, and that's the limit of my ambition, I think. Anyway. Nice to have you with us, Jazz, as usual. Interesting.
Always a pleasure to be here. I will apologize to the listeners in advance. My voice is a little shot. I think I'm coming down with the CPAC plague before arriving at CPAC.
The conservative flu. Yeah, okay. to get very serious, are they? Very disturbing article in The Guardian came out today. An investigation by them into what can only be termed a black site run by the Chicago Police Department in a nondescript warehouse on the west side of the city. It's actually a police warehouse. I mean, they have an evidence locker there, apparently. They have a storage place for vehicles. But in addition to that, they also use it as a safe house for informants who want to come in from the cold and talk to their handlers. But having said that, they also use it to bring suspects in apparently some ordinary crimes, some not so ordinary, to interrogate them with no lawyer present and without Mirandizing them. And they keep them there for hours and hours, up to a day or longer, before bringing them back to a regular precinct and then booking them. They won't admit this place exists. Which is typical Chicago way politics. If there's doing something illegal going on, deny it. That's Chicago politics. But
well, it's an old and respected tradition, Rick. I mean, yeah.
Sure it is. Sure it is. Pay no attention to that man in the videotape.
The denial part.
Yeah. Pay no attention to that man in the videotape. He's not accepting money for services rendered. Yeah.
Exactly.
Ed Berdoliak, Fast Eddie Berdoliak, an alderman, famous alderman famous for his corruption, was caught on videotape. And it's not me. That's not me. I'm not doing that. At any rate, here we have this egregious violation of civil rights, Jazz. Are you surprised at this?
Normally I'd say no, but this, in 2015, this is a little, more than a little, it's a good ways beyond what I would expect to be turning up even for Chicago. If you told me that it was happening in New Orleans or Philly 20 years ago, would not have been shocked, because it happened lots of places. But, I mean, there's been so much sunshine, so many opportunities when something like that happens to go and talk not only to your attorney, but to talk to the media, to talk to a bunch of bloggers. Somebody would get interested in the story and just say, hey, I remember where I was. This is the building. Can you check this out? Have somebody start investigating. You would think that the police realize that eventually, if you're pulling that today, you're going to get caught. It's got to come out eventually. And I guess I was wrong. Maybe they were a lot more confident in their security. Maybe they were just arrogant and thought, nope, we're in total control. Nobody's going to say anything. You know, we're good. Or maybe they're dumb. I don't know. You and I were discussing this before the show. I know that I mentioned New Orleans specifically back in the 70s. They had that. But they had everything then. They had cops who were busting drug dealers and turning them loose the next day after they confiscated all their cocaine because the cops were selling the cocaine. They were taking care of the prostitution problem by rounding up large numbers of prostitutes conveniently on nights when they were having parties. And the prostitutes would not go to jail. They would be taken back to the location of these parties the cops were having. And the next morning, they would be released with a warning. You know, these things happen. But again, that was the old days. It was before the internet. You could actually force the local media to bow a bit and, you know, even have threats and some power against them. Yeah. I didn't think that would be happening today. Apparently it is, and I'm a little dumbfounded.
Yeah, they're denying the place even exists, or they won't even talk about it. They won't comment on it. And, you know, in partly, that's probably, they're probably doing the right thing, because, as I mentioned, it's a place used by undercover officers and informants, you know, to meet and get instructions and, you know, to take the pressure off and so forth. So it's kind of a safe house type of thing. But having said that, they also have cages. They have they chain these suspects to benches for, you know, 20 hours at a time, and browbeat them and sometimes beat them up. One person died in their custody at this secret location. And the thing is, Jazz, defense attorneys in Chicago who work with indigent and poor, you know, people of color, have known about this site for years. And apparently when they try to bring it to anybody's attention, everybody just kind of turns the other, you know, the other way and doesn't even look into it. Yep. But that's Chicago. You know, since 1991, they've had three major scandals involving groups of policemen. Two of these scandals were torture scandals for which very high-ranking officers went to jail. A police captain actually served 10 years, just got out a few months ago. And then there was also, if this isn't Chicago, I don't know what is, there's a bunch of policemen running a stolen jewelry ring. They'd catch the criminals, take the jewelry, and sell it. So, you know, that's just the Chicago Police Department in some ways. But this is reminiscent of something that goes on in a communist dictatorship or you know, a theocracy or something, you know. It just doesn't happen in America. I don't care where you are in America.
Well, actually, when you were listing that communist dictatorship, a theocracy, I was about to say, or Philadelphia. But, but again, I think of that as being the past. Philly always has had something of a history. They've had some, let's just say, diversity tolerance problems in the past. It's a city of neighborhoods, and the neighborhoods are all very unique and distinct. I have heard, although I never lived there, very similar stories about Baltimore. Baltimore was terrible all the way through the 90s, what they based the series The Wire on. And apparently a lot of that was based on real life. You know, policing is hard, but you're not supposed to do that. And I guess we still have some people who haven't figured out you're not supposed to do that. But you said, by the way, and I only read part of this, you said they haven't admitted it. They haven't commented on it. They're not talking about it. Has anybody official said this, or should we technically still be saying alleged through all this?
Well, one of the former police commissioners said he knew nothing about this place. And he said if it does exist, then it shouldn't. It's terrible. It's awful. It should be taken care of. And a retired police lieutenant also didn't know about it and said, you know, I hear about this, and it scares the hell out of me, he said, as it should. It should scare all of us. I mean, you know, any of us could get caught up in something that that we know nothing about and end up in a place like this and never be seen again in some instances. But they refused comment requests from the Guardian, and they've always refused the Chicago Tribune, although the Tribune has carried incidents that happened at this secret location without putting the dots together, I guess, or, you know, connecting the dots. Somehow the Guardian was able to do this, probably because they were talking to defense attorneys who, like I said, have known about this place for years and have actually gone to this warehouse to try and talk to their clients without any success, and in fact being told no uncertain terms to leave.
I guess I can kind of understand how people working as defense attorneys, particularly if you're a public defender, but no matter what, you have to work in that court system for a long time, and you get somebody to defend, and you do your job, and they move on, and you go on to the next one, and you're still stuck dealing with the cops. I'm not excusing this in any way, but I can see how there might be less of a motivation for them to immediately go running to the press and go, look what they're doing, look what they're doing, because that might not be good for somebody's career as a defense attorney.
Sure. And, of course, the Chicago, the Cook County criminal justice system is just rife with corruption. The judge's scandal a couple of years ago where they caught something like 6, 7, 8 judges taking money from defendants to get not guilty verdicts. I mean, naked corruption. I mean, you can't get any more naked than that. That was, in fact, Peter Fitzgerald who prosecuted that as one of his first big cases. The guy who, everybody knows who Peter Fitzgerald is. So,
Judge, it doesn't pay that much, Rick. You got to make a little extra where you can.
Well, for sure. That's for sure. I mean, they're no better than aldermen. The aldermen are shameless, but they're a little less open about it. I mean, they don't have the mafia types, what they call the organization in Chicago. They don't have the organization types walking into their office with bags full of cash anymore.
God we don't have those problems with the borough presidents in New York City.
Right.
We're all on the up and up out here.
You know, nobody ever mentions the fact that they're all Democrats. I don't know whether that matters to anybody or not. It matters to me. I mean, but the fact is, if Republicans
got
in there,
Republicans.
Oh yeah, not Chicago. Chicago is. Oh, I mean, there is no Republican Party in Chicago. They don't let Republicans vote in Chicago. we had an election today. The Republican primary, they probably had about 8,000 votes total. So,
yeah. Well, South Chicago is a big city, you know.
Yeah. And the Republican mayoral candidate might get 20,000 votes to Rahm Emanuel's million. So that's how that's going to work.
I don't know what's going to become of this story, Rick. I really don't. I mean, is there any chance it's just going to go go away and disappear now that it's been brought out. Or, I mean, somebody in the city would have to go and open an investigation and try to prosecute someone. Is that going to happen?
I don't know. You know, I think it depends a lot on local media, Chicago Tribune, Chicago Sometimes, Cranes, you know, the local media, who don't do a tremendous job in investigating corruption in City Hall. There's just so much of it. They have three or four, each paper has three or four reporters who know the score, know what's going on, and could probably expose this even further, put pressure on city officials, put pressure on the new governor, who has a lot of problems of his own for sure, but Bruce Rauner, the Republican recently elected last November, he might be of a mind to take a slice out of Chicago Democrats and go after this thing. It would seem to me it needs some kind of impartial investigation to really uncover what's going on.
It sounds like something the FBI needs to be on.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that. first of all, Chicago, and you know, Eric Holder might want to, but our president might not like the idea of having people around the manual investigated, so we'll have to see. So anyway, we'll keep an eye on the story and see what happens. I'd like to welcome now our guest for this evening, Mary Catherine Hamm.
Hello, how are you guys doing?
Oh, we're doing great, Mary Catherine. Thanks for coming on.
You're on with Jazz Shaw. All right.
I know what a burden that is for you.
Yes, well, I am tedious to be around. But Rick's no prize either. You know,
yeah,
because he was supposed to
different places. I
told him he was supposed to introduce you by saying MK Hammer, the famous rap star. And he once again fell down on his duties. So
is he the guy from the '80s? MK Hammer?
Late '80s, early '90s, yes. MC Hammer.
Yeah. I haven't listened to popular music since ZZ Top, so because I like their beards, but I haven't listened to popular music in 40 years.
And by that rationale, you're a huge Duck Dynasty fan too. So.
Oh,
he's a beard guy.
I got a little beard, so, and I know Jazz has a beard. Well, Mary Catherine, before we get into Scott Walker and his travails, why don't you tell us about this new book that you've just written that nobody knew you were writing?
Yeah,
and are happy you have. So what's it about? What's the name of it? What's it about?
Yeah, so Guy Benson and I wrote a book called End of Discussion, and it is available now on Amazon or endofdiscussion.com. You can pre-order it and get it in June when it comes out. Or we'll be at CPAC handing out the first chapter and taking pictures of people and saying hi to folks. So we could do it there, too. But endofdiscussion.com is where you can find it. But it's just about this increasing cultural trend where if anyone disagrees with the modern activist left in any tiny way, we have to turn them into a social pariah and shame them on social media and possibly make them lose their jobs and genuinely pretty much try to ruin their lives is the way that this goes. And it's sort of, you know, weaponized public shame of the modern era is pretty dangerous, and the left is pretty anxious to shut the rest of us up and uses various tactics to do it. And so we go through the book on various issues, how they do that, why it's dangerous, and maybe some tactics for dealing with it.
How about some examples? Surely you must have given examples of people this has happened to or attempted.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the most famous of late is that poor Justine Sacco, who was the PR agency person who tweeted that bad joke about AIDS before she got in the plane to go across to Africa. Do you remember that?
Right.
Yeah, so she, started an international firestorm. She's just a private citizen who's like a, you know, somewhere, you know, half-decent executive at a PR company, and she makes this silly joke on Twitter, which was obviously satirical, and during her flight, she became an international phenomenon. And by the time she landed, she didn't have social media while she was in the air. Her life was completely ruined. She had to apologize internationally to the media, to everybody. She lost her job. She had become an international symbol for racism. And we're just now sort of checking back with Justine Sacco about how her life was ruined by one tweet. So that's like the kind of thing we're talking about. And then there's an example every day. I mean, the most recent, ironically, which I wrote about yesterday on Hot Air, is Patricia Arquette, who gave the utterly predictable, completely ideologically adherent equal pay spiel at the Oscars, right? Well, that's not enough for the left, my friend, because they come after the right, but they also go after each other for not being left enough. So Patricia Arquette didn't address all the grievances of all the people, the trans community, the LGBTQ, the women of color, and therefore she is now being pilloried by them.
She's not in danger of losing her job. She's got a new series coming up starting next month.
That part you say some, but it's just like this incredible tendency to say, if you do not say exactly what we believe in exactly the way we wish you to say it, then you are an evil person. And that's what she's getting online right now. It's pretty remarkable. If people of the people who are liberals and good standing get this kind of treatment, Lord knows we're not getting anything any better.
Okay, you also talked a little bit about possible tactics for dealing with it. I'm going to be curious to read about that because the internet is such – I've discussed this with Rick many times because I'm an old person and you can all get off my damn lawn. The internet ruins pretty much everything it touches. The internet just destroys everything. Social media destroys everything. For all the good that it's done, it's probably done 1,000 times worse. How does one combat that once the monster grows wings and takes off? You know, what can you possibly do?
Well, I would disagree with you about the calculation on the internet. I think it has done more good than bad, but we do have to learn to manage the bad and understand what it comes with. And some of the stuff we talk about, well, one of the questions is, okay, well, should conservatives escalate and do exactly what the left does and weaponize our own outrage and get mad about every single thing that happens all the time and try to sort of match them outrage for outrage? We certainly have our own outrage brigades who get mad about things that are sometimes silly. We also get mad about things that are righteous. Like, those are real, too. But I think we argue against trying to go blow for blow with these guys. I think one of the things that's helpful is that because they've gotten so mad about it and because they're doing it to their own, people are now starting to notice how dangerous it is. And I think Jonathan Chait just recently wrote in New York Magazine about this and got so much crap from the left about it, saying, look, hey guys, remember how we used to like free speech and not be into self-censorship and maybe we should get back to that? So I think that's a turn in the right direction. We argue that we probably shouldn't escalate and be just like the left because, frankly, if you're into that, it makes your life miserable. Like, if you are monitoring every single thing and putting it through a political prism and then going after the target, it really is exhausting and miserable. And so we're hoping to gather a coalition of people who can chill the hell out, and it can be from both sides.
Well, that would be nice. That's for you. Yeah, really. Specifically now, we've just seen, and we can start talking about Scott Walker relating to your book here. We've seen Scott Walker and Rudy Giuliani absolutely pilloried for questioning the president's patriotism in some way or another.
Right.
And, of course, the big criticism now is that, especially for Rudy Giuliani, he's tone deaf. He used a dog whistle on racism to get this done.
Right.
My question is, we've seen so much of this over the last 6 years. I mean, it's every other day, racism. Mm-hmm. Do you think the term racist is losing some of its power to shame, or is it actually getting worse?
So I thought maybe 3 years ago that it was going to lose its power, and then it sort of took another turn, and I was like, oh, no, this is just getting worse. That's one of the reasons that we wrote the book, because we were like, you know, just this incredible power of, you know, private citizens being scared to talk and the media, frankly, being able to to make the price of dissent for people on the right, just private citizens, much higher than it is for people on the left, and therefore make them more scared to speak, that's bad news. Like, we need to be talking. And, like, one of the things we talk about in the book, first of all, this Giuliani thing is just not a thing. Like, this is what I talk about. It's like the coalition to chill out. I'm not somebody who goes to the patriotism question when I'm arguing with people because I grew up with a ton of liberals. It's not useful. It's not my style. And it, as Rudy has now suggested, it obscured his message when he said it. Put that aside, it's utterly routine, especially from the left. It's politics. Sometimes people say things that are sort of crappy, and we move on because we are all people with big boy and girl pants. And the media, unfortunately, as I said on O'Reilly the other night talking about this, has to get its underoos in a bunch over only when Republicans say stuff. And the fact that it's so, the double standard is so blatant, of course, makes the price for right-leaning speakers speaking higher than it does for left ones. But you either call it both ways or you don't call it. I really wish they would just chill out. But we have to pretend like it's a giant, giant deal because it can be used to go after Scott Walker.
And well, isn't part of the problem, Mary Catherine, that the social media world and the mainstream media, cable news, network news, all that, that they have now merged together like these two horrible beasts that have suddenly mated. And,
right.
I'm sorry for that terrible analogy. But if it was just a bunch of people who are completely obsessed with politics, who were talking to each other in chat rooms and discussion forums on blogs and on Twitter with their own streams, I think the rest of the country wouldn't notice. But mainstream media
right.
has discovered Twitter and Facebook, and they look for trending hashtags, they grab
right.
it, and suddenly, boom, it's on CNN, it's on MSNBC, it gets picked up on the NBC Nightly News. So the beast has sort of consumed itself.
Yeah, no, I that's certainly part of it, that, you know, social media is so, so integrated into media coverage. I have to say also that social media gives people like me and you guys the chance to speak out as well, and to sometimes have a platform that is larger than anything we would have been afforded in the pre, you know, alternative media days. So I think that's really important because it does give us some power. But yeah, this is a huge problem, and we talk about it in the book. And one of the issues is because the media so predictably likes to cover something that is campaign-like, that pits good against evil, and of course they think we're evil. Anytime some lefty outrage group comes up with a hashtag and gets all exercised about something, they're like, oh, that's just like a campaign. This is good versus evil. This is racist versus non-racist. Let's cover that and just amp it up. And that's what happens. It gets covered in the style of a campaign, and that's how these things sort of take off and become their own, you know, world-overtaking hashtag and whatnot. But it's certainly, we are definitely at a disadvantage.
Yeah. You know, Jazz has some interesting thoughts on this. We talked about this a few weeks ago, Jazz, where when the Democrats get into trouble or when they're not doing well, these stories seem to blow up a lot bigger than when the Democrats are doing very well. Do you think there's a correlation there?
Yes. Sorry, were you going
to...
Go ahead, Jeff.
Was that for Mary Catherine or me? Because I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Well, you were on the show when we had Matt Luce, weren't you? Okay. Maybe you didn't say it. Maybe it was
Matt. I think
Matt
might have said that. Yes.
Anyway, Matt Lewis said that.
okay.
When things are going bad for Democrats, these incidents seem to get blown all out of proportion.
Oh yes, I do. I do think that is part of how it works. And yeah, because if there were other things to crow about this past weekend, except for Giuliani, who, by the way, is not an elected official anywhere. He's not really a leader of the party, except for in a sort of, I guess, rhetorical sense on TV sometimes. But the idea that that was a big deal, of course, there's some sort of gap that they're filling, which is that they can't be crowing about things that they're actually doing. The other problem of imbalance, which we talk about in the end of discussion, is the the problem of emblemism, which is whenever, of course, a Republican does something, every single Republican and every single conservative on Twitter or in the public eye or not in the public eye has to answer for what that person did.
Right.
And on the left, that just doesn't exist. Like, and we use the perfect example of this was when Mayor Bob Filner, who was formerly Congressman Bob Filner, who had been feeling women up, apparently, and harassing them for 10, 15 years, it turns out, and had various complaints lodged against him, and everybody had turned a blind eye because he was a Democrat and he votes the right way, and this was not war on women, hashtag war on women, because he's on the left. No senators were asked to answer for that. Nancy Pelosi wasn't asked to answer for the fact that he was in her caucus for 10 years feeling up women and violating them and not being punished and held to account for it. He just sort of eventually got pushed out of office by the women who were coming forward in San Diego and by sort of the alternative media going, hey, man, like, this guy actually has to pay a price. And then he, of course, you know, had to pay a legal price. but that did not get reflected all over the country onto every single other Democrat. So there's an incredible imbalance in the way that the media addresses these things. If one random Tennessee Republican state senator says something, then everybody else has to be asked about it. Not so for the left.
Yeah.
And it's more, I think, evident in a campaign season for – it's not just everybody in Congress or anything like that, but people who are up for election in a tight election and presidential candidates. And this
right.
was the dispute that's been going on between Matt Lewis just in the last few days and me and Ed Morrissey. And
right.
Ed and I both wrote about that today. And the, you know, what's his name, Giuliani, says something. And, of course, they immediately come up and have to ask Scott Walker about it. And when they get around to it, they'll be asking they already did. They asked Marco Rubio. They asked, you know, just right down the line. Meanwhile, we saw very, very recently former Vermont Governor Dean on Joe Scarborough's show, who sat there and said that Scott Walker was too, quote, unknowledgeable to be the president mm-hmm. of the United States. And the question I asked, out of all these reporters, has anyone tried to go and ask Hillary if she agrees
right.
with that? If she doesn't, will she disown that and
right.
chastise our dean? And
right.
it doesn't happen. Nobody asks her anything.
Well, yeah, does she ever get asked anything? She's just, like, floating around from dinner to dinner, not getting asked any questions. And, like, I think one of the things we're learning as this gears up, because I generally am not surprised by the media, but in this case, I was like, 5 days later, I was like, is this Giuliani thing really still going on? I can't believe this is a thing, because it was so stupid. But I think what we're learning is how vicious this cycle is going to be with the fire coming from the media. We're not even dealing with Hillary or other Democrats who are running yet. And candidates do need to think very carefully about how they want to answer these questions. Now that we know that everything's going to be turned back on you. Now, I'm probably, I hate to be this person, but like a little bit between Matt Lewis and you guys, maybe a little closer to you guys on this question. I do think Scott Walker gave them one sentence that they could cling to on the Christian question and turn it into something it was not. But I think his tack is right, which is to turn it around and say, what are you people talking about? Explain to me why this matters. You are the problem with this country. The problem is just do it without giving them that one little thing to hang their hat on. I think he's moving in the right direction, and I think he's done it on several subjects now, and I think if he keeps that drumbeat up, it will be important. On the issue of the president's face, I think the perfect answer is, excuse me, Washington Post reporter, the president has spoken publicly about his face many times. Why are you asking this question? Do you have doubts about it? And then move on and say, I don't understand why this is a problem.
Well, the fact is 47% of the country doesn't know if Obama's a Christian. Not all Republicans either. So, you know,
it's just utterly fruitless and stupid. It has nothing to do with any policy that's coming across anybody's desk. And the guy's going to be out of office mercifully in 2 years anyway. So let's
right.
Anyway, it's just the idea that that's a question that comes up when you have one shot at asking the current frontrunner of the party a question, that's what comes up. It's just pathetic. And we should treat, candidates should treat the press like they're pathetic when they do that.
Yeah, it wasn't just the idea. I mean, the question that that he was asked wasn't the only question that he's been excoriated for over the last couple of weeks. He was in Europe, in London, and was asked about evolution and said he didn't want to comment on it. Well, that set off the alarm bells on the left and among the press. You know, he doesn't believe in evolution. He believes that dinosaurs
right.
walk with people or, you know, whatever. When, in fact, that was the smart thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, I think any Republican who gets asked that question, he was probably just asked out of blue and was absolutely floored by it, I'm sure, which is why he didn't want to comment on it.
Right.
But like the rape questions that Republicans keep getting tripped up about somehow,
right.
somebody hasn't sat down with them and said, this is how you answer this question, guys.
Right.
You know, the way you answer that question and the question of his rate of his patriotism and faith should be rote. It should be every single candidate should respond the same way, and that would be that. They wouldn't ask it anymore.
Right. Well, and I think on the evolution question, his answer is what I was talking about, where he seems to be building this strategy of pushing back on them about these lines of questioning, which I think can do what you're saying it might do, which is just to take this off the table. But I do think, like, if you're going to go that route, you maybe have to be a little bit more forceful about it, a Chris Christie-style amount of force when you're turning back on these guys. I think a good example was Mitt Romney, or a good example of not being forceful enough was Mitt Romney coming back on the first birth control question in that first debate where Stephanopoulos brought it up, and all of us were completely confused because why were we asking questions about birth control? Well, of course, it turned out to be all part of a strategy to turn us into the party of anti-birth control, which we are, of course, not. But Romney did basically say, what are you talking about? This is not an issue. But he was so taken aback and so surprised, and naturally not a super forceful guy, that he didn't come back at Stephanopoulos, I think, hard enough. And we need to be thinking about that, like refuting these lines of questioning and refuting them really hard, because they don't matter. And they don't matter to regular
yeah.
people.
Yeah,
well,
absolutely.
Let's be fair here. Now, first of all, on the thing with Walker when he was over in Britain, you know, there are so many evolution-related pieces of legislation going through Congress, even as we speak, that people do want to know about that, you know, because that's going to impact. No.
We're all evolution all the time up here.
Exactly.
Right.
Now, Ed and I have been working on the beginning of a little bit of a handbook for candidates of things they could say when they get asked these questions.
Good.
And my favorite one for evolution so far, next time one of the candidates, like Walker or whoever, someone comes up and says, do you believe in evolution? I think the rote answer for every one of them should be, you know, I've heard some pretty strong arguments in favor of it until I met you, but it's clearly failed in your family line. So I'm no longer sure. Next question. And always answer it. I'll always end it with next question.
Another favorite of my of the double standards for me is, you know, so the president gets asked about, so all the Republicans get asked about vaccinations. And first of all, the anti-vax crowd is largely left to center and kooky liberal. So the Democrats should have to answer them for them, and yet it's Republicans who have to answer for them. So they're all asked about it and have to give really detailed answers about what they feel about policy and the freedom to object and what exactly the parameters should be. And the president's asked about vaccinations, and he says, you should vaccinate your kids. And then the press moves on. Well, if that's an acceptable answer, that's sure. That does sound like a reasonable answer. Except that's not the answer any Republicans is allowed to give. They have to have an entire policy paper about the parameters of vaccination law.
Yeah, because they're walking a fine line in many cases answering a question like vaccinations, because they have a very strong, there are people many people in the base who have a very strong opinion about it, and you don't want to offend them, while at the same time you want to be reasonable, logical, and you know, scientific,
right,
and say, yeah, the vaccinations work. They're very safe. I vaccinated my own children, and
right,
that's that.
Well, and I would argue, like, really it's the Democrats who should be scared of this question. It's just that nobody's going to press them on it. Because Democrats' base is the one that's more anti-vaccination than the right, if you look at the numbers. So it's just aggravating, once again, with the double standards. And if a Republican candidate doesn't say exactly what they want, what the sort of lefty answer is to every single question, then it's, oh, God, he doesn't believe in science. Oh, God, she hates black people for sure. I mean, it's so transparent and just not good for anybody having a discussion.
Even knowing that the media is going to be coming with these, though, there are just two things to ask you to comment on. One, and I know you've already sort of given a head nod to this, just like the Democrats, we do have plenty of Republicans who say stupid things sometimes. That's
yeah,
just a given. And when you get into the whole rape birth control thing particularly, and you start
mm-hmm,
asking a group of old white men, we could probably use some handlers that provide better training, like the one guy, the story popped up on Monday, who apparently stood up in session, and it was about a anti-abortion bill, and said, well, could we force the woman to swallow a camera first so we can get an internal look? And it took one of the female Republicans to sort of lean over and go, they're not connected.
It's,
you know,
not going
to
work.
Like,
yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's not how it works. If she swallows a pill, it doesn't show up in her vagina, you know. So you need a little bit of basic training for that. But more to the point, if you know you're going to get tackled with these questions, sometimes I have to wonder, like, on the vaccination thing is probably the best starter. You already mentioned it's mostly the left. There are some on the right. I got some bad letters when I wrote a thing saying,
everybody
should get vaccinated. But
right,
how big of a slice of the base is that? I mean, do we not need to have candidates who will realize, you know, I can go out and say that I support vaccinations. The number of people I tick off is going to be so minimal, it's
right,
it's going to be a blip on the radar. I can go out and say, I don't know for sure because I'm a religious person, but, you know, science and religion aren't always incompatible, and evolution is a very solid theory for a lot of people. How many votes are you really going to lose when you say that?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the vaccination question, on the right, not very many, which is why it seems like a no-brainer just to answer that in a solid way, pro-vaccination, not trip yourself up with too much, you know, hemming and hawing and move on, because that while there are some on the right, it's certainly not the same magnitude as on the left. As Catherine Miller at BuzzFeed wrote a good piece about Republicans answering this question, sort of hemming and hawing about it, and saying, guys, you're appealing to the wrong fringe. It's the West fringe. Like, it's not Omaha where you have these outbreaks of whooping cough. It's freaking LA. Like, these people aren't voting for you.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, there,
it should be a low risk thing for us.
The thing about that the guy who talked about the camera, the woman swallowing the camera, he's a backbench Idaho state representative, for crying out loud. I mean,
right.
He
and
might
the
as well be a dog catcher.
About it, right. The reason we know about it is because the media is motivated to report on somebody like him, whereas if there's a dumb guy who's a Democrat who says something, the national media is not motivated to pick that up. So
right,
you're always getting the dumb guy on this side and not on the other side.
One of the more hysterical things a congressman has said in the last 10 years was said by Mel, says somebody or other, and I can't remember his name right now, it's not off the topic. Talk about Guam sinking into the ocean because there'll be
over,
too many people.
Tipping over,
tipping over. I mean, that is the most hysterical thing. And he said it with deadpan. He was absolutely serious. And where did that go? I mean, it was prominent on conservative media, but you never heard about it anywhere. You know,
yeah,
it's
that's one of the rare ones that was entertaining enough that it broke through for a brief instance. So there are people who have heard of it, but if that wasn't Republican, it would have gone down in history as one of the dumbest things ever said.
Oh, absolutely.
It was sort of a flip in this case.
I agree with that completely. There was the one guy, his first name was Daniel, I don't remember his last name, in Oregon, and he was a Democrat, and he was the guy the picture showed up of him wearing the Tigger costume.
Oh, yeah.
But before that, he had just been showing up at meetings and saying this series of more and more bizarre things, like the guy was I feel bad laughing. He was desperately in need of medication, and he wasn't
mm-hmm.
getting it, and he was
right.
just gone around the bend. If that had been a Republican, he would still be being featured on Letterman every night, or at least once a week. But it disappeared. It just went away.
I think his name was Wu.
I think it was Daniel Wu, yeah. Kind of a tragic figure, but I'm sorry, I'm a mean person. It was funny. I posted the picture. You know?
He's crazy.
Rick, talk about patriotism.
I want to bring it up. Mary Catherine didn't sound very enthusiastic about it, so I've been avoiding it. But I think it's an important issue for this reason.
Well, Mary Catherine's not a good
I think that there are too many people on the right who have a definition of patriotism and don't think that there is any other way you can be patriotic except their way. Now, the first question I have to ask Mary Catherine, I know what the answer is going to be, but I'd like to expound on it. Is there only one way to love the United States of America?
No, I actually am not interested in questioning people's patriotism. I make a point of not doing that just because I don't think it's the right thing to do, because I think I should have, you know, some good faith assumptions about my fellow Americans unless they show me otherwise, such as a Bill Ayers, for instance. I can, you know, I can draw some conclusions about his patriotism and his love of country, I think. But for the most part, like, yeah, I want to assume that my fellow countrymen and women do love their country. And yes, it is a little bit different. And we can also stipulate that there are two different kinds, like that there are different kinds of ways to love your country, and that conservatives are more likely to say, I love this country, it's the greatest country on earth, and add no qualifications. If you ask a liberal the same question, they would say, I love this country, and here's some things that could make it the greatest country on earth.
Exactly.
So those are two different styles. They're two different ways of thinking about things. I do not think that one is un-American and one is pro-American.
You know, I'm not going to – I don't want to just drag this back to the whole double standard thing. But
right.
just as a reference point, there are plenty of people on the left who – I don't want to use the phrase accuse conservatives of not loving America, but you'll see in a second. Eugene Robinson, Pulitzer Prize winner, writes for The Washington Post, was on Scarborough this week, but once again, or it might have been the end of last week, and this whole discussion about Walker came up. And he just dropped off the edge of the map and launched into this extemporaneous discussion with the host of the show. And he answered that question by saying, and starting out like he was going to sound like he was totally reasonable. And he said, I think people on both sides love the country, but there's a difference. And that's when my ears perked up, because I was waiting, like, okay, here comes the but.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, liberals, or whatever he said, progressives, people on the left, they tend to look at the country, and they look at it as a living, breathing thing, something that grows, something that needs nurturing and occasionally pruning, and it evolves, and they love it in a way that they want to keep perfecting it. And conservatives absolutely love the country, but they love the country from the 1950s that their parents loved. And they call them conservatives because they like to conserve things. And they would like to conserve it the way it was back then, and they just don't want it to change. Doesn't mean they don't love it, but see, we just love it differently. So he starts out like he's going to say, I agree with Mary Catherine, and everybody loves the country, but then he manages to say, but we love the country the correct way, and we're trying to improve it, and you guys are dinosaurs. You know, so,
yeah.
I don't think he's unique.
No, I think it's a hallmark, and we talk about this in the book, it's a hallmark of the left to question anyone right of center's motives and to assume they are a terrible person who just wants racism and to hurt brown people. And they're probably, like, I mean, the president and the Democrats on various occasions have called us, called elected Republicans, what, terrorists, hostage takers, suicide bombers. The problem is, of course, we always run into this, it is the double standard that rhetoric only matters for one side. Only we are policed. Only we are the ones who have to rein it in. You know, Eugene Robinson can say whatever he wants. The president can be as dismissive or assume horrible things about Republicans as much as he wants in all of his speeches, and nobody says a daggone thing. I mean, he's actually flat out said before that Republicans want, like, dirtier air and water. That's our goal. So, yes, I mean, questioning no good faith in your fellow Americans is a hallmark of the left. I do not want to aspire to that particular characteristic, so I try to cut them more slack than they, or give them more benefit of the doubt than they give me. Some people think that that's not the right way to do it, but I like going down that path.
Yes, you're similar to my situation in that you grew up with liberals. I grew up in a family of 10 kids, and 9 of them are liberals. My parents were FDR Democrats. I cannot say that the way they love America is unpatriotic. It's just not in my blood. I've been fighting this fight for 10 years, and every time I write about it, I get comments about how un-American I am. So,
I think you're sort of on, I think we're on the right path talking about that there are two different attitudes and that, like, we don't have to think one is great and one is horrible. Because it is true. We should not pretend that the idea of national pride and patriotism and sort of flag waving kind of thing, that is something that makes liberals real comfortable. Because it's not. Like, they would openly tell you that's not really their thing. And that they go about things in a different manner. So let's not pretend that it's exactly the same way, but we don't have to denigrate it either.
I have one major problem with taking the high road, and that's something that I've been writing about again this week, and people get tired of it. And actually, I get criticized, you know, even from the right, about trying to bring this up. And the fact is, the media, being as biased as it is not harmless. It does have an effect, and has a major effect. And
no, but let me ask you the question. In this case, not taking the high road, which is what, like, Giuliani could have made his argument without saying that one sentence. And in fact, Giuliani prefaced his sentence by saying, "I know this is a horrible thing to say, and if you ever preface something with that, you should stop talking."
Right.
But,
absolutely.
Here's the problem, because the media was so biased, him not taking the high road caused a lot of this uproar. He didn't get anything by saying this, right? He didn't gain any ground by saying this. So I think strategically, not just morally, strategically it would have been smarter to just leave that part out and to have a discussion about policies and do it without making that argument, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I agree with that, but I also was not going to use Rudy Giuliani as an example of not taking the high road. Rudy Giuliani was taking the stupid road. What I was referring to, let's take a little bit cleaner, less, sore point, push-the-needle type subject about the possible shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security, which everybody's been writing about, everybody's been talking about. And Marco Rubio struck a great blow, I think, for the point that I'm trying to make here. And it's not that we should be attacking Democrats, but we should be fearlessly attacking the media and not playing by the rules of just saying, that's how they are. And as Rubio pointed out, we went through all these years where the Republicans in the Senate were in the minority, and I happen to be one of the people who accused Ted Cruz. You can't be the person filibustering and refusing to pass the bill and then saying, "I didn't shut the government down." Because we did, okay? It was us.
Yeah.
It's on us.
Yep.
But now, and that was the case that Rubio pointed out, when we filibustered and didn't pass the funding, we got blamed for shutting the government down. The Democrats are now filibustering and shutting down the government, and the Republicans are getting blamed for it. And there's a reason for that. It's because it gets repeated in the media day in and day out, and then they run that poll. Well, who's going to be at fault if this happens? And they've done it. A small majority is willing to blame the Republicans. It's too frustrating for words.
Yeah, no, I understand. I'm totally with you on the frustration. I think the key, and some of what we talk about in the book, which, by the way, is available for pre-order at endofdiscussion.com, is being forceful.
I was going to give you a chance to sell it at the end when you went off, but that's fine. You can anytime, Mary Catherine.
Hey,
you can bring it up.
I have to train for this for being a saleswoman. I think the key is picking your battles and being forceful. Without being stupid, right? So in this case, Marco Rubio is talking about the right thing, and Giuliani was, you know, taking the wrong tack. And obviously, I do think being forceful with the media without being dumb about the way you're doing it is key to winning some of these battles, because it is an unfair field, and you do have to push back, and you do have to make sure that that someone else hears the actual message. Actually, this reminds me briefly, the filibuster issue reminds me of when I was a kid. If I left a cup on the floor with some kind of, you know, with soda in it or whatever, and my dad kicked it over, it was my fault for leaving it on the floor. If my dad left a cup on the floor with something in it and I kicked it over, it was my fault for not looking where I was going.
Right.
So that is the standard by which we're being judged here.
But I do think you're correct, though, that pushing back on the media, I think, is important, but it carries its own inherent risks, and you're absolutely correct. It has to be done in a smart way, and that's what
I
was
record,
writing about.
For the record, I never won that debate with my father, so we have to be careful.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Well,
but you can't be
the
guy,
problem,
if they ask you a dumb, offensive question, and which they always do, you can't be the guy that responds by leaning over in close while the cameras and the mics are still on and saying, if you ever say that again, I'm going to throw you off the Rotunda balcony.
Yes, that would be going from forceful to stupid, yes.
Right. You've gone from first gear to fifth, and you know you can't do that. You got to remain calm, but you have to be strong and say, you know, you're doing a terrible job. That's not something that's worthy of my time to discuss. I'm moving on to the next question. You know, things like that. But not, I'm going to kill you and throw you off the balcony.
Yeah.
So, just a tip for all you Michael Grimm fans.
Well, and I mean, there is power in the idea of next question, is there not? Like, you're surrounded by a bunch of people who want to talk to you.
Right.
If you forcefully refute a question instead of like, oh, pass, like you're scared, you're like, that's a terrible question. It has nothing to do with national policy. Moving on to the next guy, you. I mean, you're being followed by 20 people. Someone will have a question for you.
Yeah.
And half of them will never get a chance normally, and they would love the opportunity to get a question in. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
One last point. One more point I'd like to cover, but we got about 2 minutes left. Josh Ernst, White House spokesman, when asked about Giuliani's patriotism question, said, well, I don't understand why this is a problem. The president has said many times that he loves America. We're supposed to accept what this man, you know, you can keep your insurance if you want it. You can keep your doctor if you want it.
Right.
We're drawing a red line in Syria. We're supposed to accept what this guy says at face value. If Giuliani, Mary Catherine, had framed that question in the context of credibility of the president,
Right.
Do you think it would have made a difference?
Maybe slightly. I think once you throw that patriotism flag, like, you know, the bulls are running. So I'm not sure if it would have made a huge difference, but I think you're totally correct. By the way, just a couple weeks ago, it was Axelrod himself who said, oh, yeah, the president was totally lying about his position on gay marriage for years. And this is something he allegedly really, really, really cares about, and I can't believe that. I can believe it because it's such dedicated leftist. But gay marriage advocates should be so angry that he stood on the sidelines when he agreed with them for all that time and did nothing, and yet they're just giving us a full pass. But like the idea that that we're supposed to take him at face value all the time, even though his own closest advisor is saying, and sycophant is saying, oh yeah, he totally lied about that for years. it's just insane. And this is one thing I love about the president is when he stands up, and I've written about this many times in Hot Air, when he stands up and says, you know, scolds us for our cynicism, you made us cynics, dude. He is the idea that you would not be skeptical of everything he says is irrational. It's completely irrational. He's given you every reason to think he is lying at every turn. And therefore, bring your cynicism to the table, people. We need it.
Yeah. Well, Mary Catherine, we've run out of time, I'm afraid, and we're going to have to let you go. But before we do, one more time, name of the book and where we can buy it.
Yes, it is called End of Discussion. You can find it on Amazon, or you can get it at endofdiscussion.com. Follow me at MK Hammer on Twitter, or see me on Hot Air with my good friend Jazz and all of the hardworking guys over there. They really turn out amazing work every day, all day long. It's pretty astounding.
Yeah, I don't know if you should say hard worker in the same sentence you say Jazz Shaw. So we'll just let that go. Thanks again, Mary Catherine. We'll have you back again, I hope, sometime in the near future, and have you talk about the book a little more.
Glad to. I really enjoyed being on with you guys. All right, bye-bye.
Hey, it's always a pleasure. I'll see you down at CPAC.
Sounds good. Bye.
Bye.
Mary Catherine Hamm. Buy her book, End of Discussion, endofdiscussion.com. And Jan's going to have to say goodbye to you. Once again,
indeed,
you performed fearlessly. You performed magnificently. I can't say enough about your performance tonight.
Okay.
You're welcome.
I
so
did
thanks
my
a
best,
lot, Jan.
Thank you for having me, yes, because I always enjoy coming.
I'll try to keep you off the air for at least 2 weeks this time.
Oh, that works.
Yeah.
I'll be dragging you on my show in a couple of weeks, so we'll talk to you there.
Okay. Sounds good. Take it easy, Jazz.
Take care.
And join me again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.